Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
As the Supreme Court hears the case for marriage equality, New Jersey legislators will soon be considering what happens when marriage comes to an end. David Cruz for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. A new bill in the New Jersey State Assembly would end permanent alimony payments and create other regulations on spousal support. But what exactly is alimony's role in modern divorce? Laura Morgan joins us now to get into this gray area. She owns and operates Family Law Consulting and is also one of the authors of the American Bar Association's forthcoming Alimony Handbook. Laura, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Good morning.
So, listeners, we'd like to hear from you, too, on this. Has alimony been a factor in your decision whether or not to get divorced? Do you think it's time to end the practice for good? Or does it just need some tweaking? Call us up now at 212-433-WNYC, married or single or divorced. 212-433-9692. Laura Morgan can also take your questions on alimony and divorce. So, Laura, what was alimony's original purpose and what is its role today?
Well, alimony has really gone through a very tortured history, and we've ended up in the place that we're really not quite sure what it's for. 100 years ago, it was pretty simple. You know, a man and a woman got married. The woman usually didn't work. She stayed home. She tended house. She raised the children. And if the marriage dissolved, alimony was a measure to maintain the recipient spouse, the woman, in the same standard of living she would have enjoyed had the marriage remained intact. Alimony was seen almost like contract damages for the contract being broken, and almost in some cases punishment for the bad husband who might have left her or committed adultery. Women couldn't get alimony if she was the partner at fault. Alimony really began to go through a big change in the 70s when the Uniform Marriage and Divorce Act was adopted by many states. This is usually called the UMDA. This act, adopted by a number of states, knocked out fault and economic and the notion of economic dependency, because the act presumed that all women were employable, that once the marriage ended, they could just go out and get a job. The UMDA makes it very difficult. It's a very high standard in order to get alimony. The woman had to lack sufficient property in it and had to be unable to provide for her own reasonable needs through appropriate employment. Now, what happened was, like, in the next 10 years, 15 years, it became pretty apparent that women faced barriers to employment that the drafters of the UMDA really hadn't seen, that the glass ceiling was still very much in place, that women were still out of the job market, tending to the home, and finding very difficult barriers to get back in. So there was this new wave of reform, kind of doing away with some of the difficulties of the UMDA. And the new wave in the 80s and early 90s basically gave judges much more discretion on awarding alimony. It introduced, the concept of rehabilitative alimony. It expanded the list of factors that judges could consider in awarding alimony. But it really left the question of, well, what is the measure of alimony going to be, kind of unanswered. So what happened thereafter was an attempt by many states to try to quantify this measure of alimony. How much should a recipient spouse get, given this expanded list of factors of when it should be awarded in the first place? And on one hand, you had what's called the ALI principles, which is the American Law Institute principles on the dissolution of marriage. Very formulaic, using things like number of income, you know, combined income and number of years, and it's almost like a calculus. lots of states started adopting alimony guidelines, again, very formulaic.
Where's the push for that coming from?
Well, I think the push to make it more quantifiable was coming from both the judiciary and the legislature because, as I said, the question of what should the appropriate measure be was unanswered. And what has happened now is that there's a retraction of those very factors that allowed alimony to be awarded in more circumstances, and now the pendulum is swinging back the other way. So we have a combination of a recognition that women are now more employable. They can get into the workforce, and we were trying to answer how much should this be.
So is there an alimony reform movement, or is this just certain states?
Well, so far, we do see movement. I mean, we've seen movement in Florida, New Jersey, New York, and Massachusetts is the last big state to have a big alimony reform. I think it's probably going to spread. But again, you know, it's not going to gain traction or come to acceptable results to anybody, to any state, unless you can figure out, well, what is alimony supposed to accomplish?
Right. And so that's almost, I mean, kind of reflects the changes in how people enter into marriage.
Yes, I think so.
So what kind of reforms do the New Jersey bill and other similar laws call for?
Well, the New Jersey bill, as I understand it, it's Bill A3909, is modeled on the Massachusetts bill that was signed into law a couple years ago. What it does is it generally ends alimony when the payor reaches retirement age, and that is a change. Prior to this, most states, it said, you know, in appropriate circumstances, indefinite alimony can be awarded. And so there is now this push to end alimony when the payor reaches retirement. And the law also establishes a formula for alimony. Remember I said there was this push to have it quantifiable.
Right.
And this Massachusetts law does that. It has a formula based on the length of the marriage. For example, alimony would last no more than 10 and a half years following a 15-year marriage. There is still a measure of discretion left for the judge that a judge can award indefinite alimony for an extreme long-term marriage. And in the case of very short marriages, a judge can order what's called reimbursement alimony, which is a very funky kind of alimony. It's not really alimony at all, I don't think, but that's what they call it.
Yeah. Would the change affect people who are paying alimony now, or is there some kind of grandfathering of this?
Well, you can apply for a modification of alimony based on the new statute, but you have to do it within 2 years. Ooh. So in Massachusetts, the changes took effect in March 2012, and the people who are paying lifetime alimony, that is indefinite alimony, can file for a modification so that it does terminate on retirement starting in late 2013.
I'm assuming that these laws don't specifically deal with gender, but
gender neutral.
Is it still generally?
I say he and she, but that's just a matter of convenience.
Yeah.
They are completely gender neutral.
So do we see still more men obviously paying alimony than women?
Yes, because women still have the greater burden of childbearing, child raising. They are the ones more often that do have career disruption in order to care for the family.
What are some of the considerations for awarding alimony to men?
Well, you know, stay-at-home dads, obviously, would be a category of men. And if the woman's earning power, you know, greatly outstrips the man's, and she has been the one who's been the major bread earner and provided the elevated standard of living, that would be a case for a woman paying man alimony. As I recall, I think Ashton Kutcher asked for alimony.
Would equal pay for women level the alimony playing field?
It would certainly be one of the pieces of the puzzle that would help level the playing field for alimony that would make it less necessary for women as opposed for men.
All right, let's get a call in here. Michelle? Yeah, Michelle is in Bergen County. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay, thanks for calling.
I have a friend who got divorced. She was married, no children, to this gentleman. He didn't have any children. It was his second marriage for both. They were married about 7 years. During the first 7 years, she had a high executive position. He was an executive. She had a high executive position. She had been working for many years. After about 7 years, she decided she wanted to turn her hobby into a business, and she started a little business, which went defunct. She separated from her husband after about the 15th year. He supported her. 5 years later, they're divorced. She has Social Security, her own pension, which is quite substantial, and a 401k worth approximately between $800 and $1 million. He has to pay her lifetime alimony. There's no children. And the alimony was based on the fact that she was entitled to live in the style to which she was accustomed to.
I heard a lot of, Michelle, thanks for your call. Laura, I hear a lot about that. You know, somebody receiving what we may think is an exorbitant amount of money, but it's based on a lifestyle that they maintained during the marriage.
That's the key factor here in all alimony awards, or most alimony awards, is what is termed the marital standard of living. If a marital standard of living was established that's, you know, extremely high, then what the family court is trying to do is maintain both parties to the best extent possible at that same marital standard of living. Only in the most extreme high-income cases are you going to be able to do that without a diminution in the standard of living for either party. So what the alimony award is trying to do is equalize the loss as best it can. You don't want the loss to fall completely on one party. So, no, there shouldn't be exorbitant alimony awards on men that they can't pay. But, you know, for every example of that, you can find an example of a woman who got the short end of the stick and can't support herself and the kids.
Right. Laura Morgan owns and operates Family Law Consulting. She's also one of the authors of the American Bar Association soon-to-be-published Alimony Handbook. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. Has alimony been a factor in your decision whether or not to divorce or to marry? Do you think it's time to end the practice for good, or does it just need some tweaking? Give us a call at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Let's talk to Adriana in Montclair.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for getting my call. I'm actually going through a divorce right now, and I am from Mexico, and I have been married for 16 years, and I don't have any family here. So while talking to my lawyer, and it's been kind of like a messy divorce, I don't see any consideration for foreigners who do not have family here and whether or not that should be something that the judge should take into account for awarding me the alimony that I'm requesting.
Adriana, thanks for your call. What about that, Laura?
I agree with you that whether you have family to help you or not is not a factor. I haven't seen that. I would like you to clarify, what do you think that the judge should take into consideration that they're not?
Adriana?
I want to be very fair, and I want his needs to take into account, my needs to take into account. But my expenses are bigger because I have to travel to see my family. We also have a child who has a wonderful, I mean, she grew accustomed to visit her grandparents in Mexico every year and have vacations there. So that is a factor that now with the reduction of income, I'm not going to be able to afford anymore. So, you know, granting, I would like the judge to see that I have more needs to travel. Does that make sense?
Yes, I understand. I understand your question now. You're saying that you would like, as one of the factors, your expense of travel to your family in Mexico. Well,
so my family, you know, and other support, yes.
Okay.
Because, like, for example, I move and I didn't have anybody to help me here. You know, like, he has more of a network.
The general expenses of being in the country alone.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. Laura? Well, when people go through a dissolution of marriage, and in unmarried couples, you know, who split up, and in child support cases, whether the parents are married or not, you have to fill out a very extensive financial affidavit that lists your income and expenses. And the judge will see the expenses, and the judge has to decide what's an appropriate expense and what's not an appropriate expense to base support on. Now, if your child has, you know, very, very close ties to his or her grandparents, the judge could say, yeah, that's an appropriate expense, and that could be factored into the child support award, the travel for the child. But the judge is going to say, you know, is your travel to Mexico or to help, you know, have other people help you that you, when you can't have friends, is that an expense that we have to take into consideration? As I said, the statutes for alimony have a list of factors, and expenses is one of them, but there's a lot of discretion on what kind of expense will be considered.
All
you can do is, you know, have your lawyer or you argue the best you can about why this is a necessary expense.
All right, Adriana, thank you for your call. Kevin is in Manhattan. Kevin, welcome to the program. Hi, Kevin, you there? Kevin, hi. All right, Kevin's not there. We'll try and get him back. Has the rise of prenuptial agreements changed the way that spousal support is awarded in?
Well, a prenuptial agreement can cover how property is divided on dissolution. It can cover incidences of support. It cannot cover anything to do with children. So you can't do anything dealing with custody or child support in a prenuptial agreement.
On issues like that and sort of what Adriana was talking about a minute ago, how much judicial discretion is there?
Regarding
child support and some of the instances that she was talking about needing travel expenses and that sort of thing. Does the judge have room to make decisions on that?
Yes. In a different way. All states have child support guidelines. New York has them. New Jersey has them. Every single state has child support guidelines. And that's as the result of a 1988 federal law called the Family Support Act, which mandated that states have child support guidelines. However, all the guidelines say once you, you know, plug in the numbers into this formula, the judge has discretion to deviate from the presumptive award. That means, you know, you can add or subtract for appropriate expenses or extra income.
All right, let's get one more call in here. Kevin is back. Kevin in Manhattan. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. I'm disabled, and at one point, you know, me and the wife were having problems and considering divorce, and we have a home that's catered to my disability and everything, and I was just wondering how I would be affected if it ever came to that.
How do you mean, Kevin?
Like, just basically, I could not maintain the same lifestyle, you know, without her income, and, you know, how would the home be split since the home is catered to disability?
Is it jointly owned, I guess?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What about that, Laura?
Well, this is a question not of alimony or child support. It's a question of property division and what's called equitable distribution of property in New York and New Jersey. And there you have to classify the property. Whether it's jointly titled really doesn't matter. It has to be classified
as marital or separate, and that's going to depend on what funds were used to acquire it. Now, if this home was acquired during the marriage with marital funds, then it's marital property, and then the judge would, if it's in normal circumstances, not yours, a judge would just, you know, decide, well, who, you know, how should the house be split? You know, should one party buy out the other party? We award possession to one party. Now, your circumstances are special. As a matter of property division, the judge could decide, you know, this house has been fitted out for your disability. It's appropriate that you stay there. And he or she could quite possibly say that the wife has to buy out your interest and then award you the house.
That's an area with judicial discretion, yeah?
Again,
yeah.
Yes.
All right. So in your opinion, what's the best way to fairly assign alimony?
What do you mean, assign? You mean measure it?
Yes.
Decide how much?
Yeah.
Well, you know, we're never going to be able to decide how much until we decide what it's for.
Mm.
And until we decide what it's for, you know, all these formulas and aren't going to answer everybody's needs. If we decide that, you know, it's a replacement for income, or as the ALI principles say, it's a way to share the burden of lost earning capacity of a marriage, and a way to share the burden of the diminution in the standard of living. You know, if you can focus in on what it's for, then you can have economists come up with formulas. If you're still going to say it's punishment for fault or it's contract damages, then you're still going to have a very wide spectrum of awards left up to the discretion of the judge.
So alimony laws are a living and breathing thing, and in 10 years they could be totally different, no?
Absolutely. They've changed since, you know, from 100 years ago. They're a completely different animal, and I think right now we're in the third wave of reform, and there might, you know, there will be, I'm not going to say there might be, there will be a fourth wave 20 years from now.
All right. Laura Morgan owns and operates Family Law Consulting. She's also one of the authors of the American Bar Association's soon-to-be-published Alimony Handbook. Laura, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for your calls on this. So will same-sex couples ever have to worry about alimony payments? Michael Lavers checks in from Washington for an update on the demonstrations for and against marriage equality. That's coming up next on WNYC.
And he thinks C-U-S-T-O-D-Y spells fun or play. I spell out all the hurting words and turn my head when I speak. 'Cause I can't spell.